One of the most convincing aspects of the mystic illumination is the apparent revelation of the oneness of all things. An elaborate logic, beginning with Parmenides and culminating in Hegel and his followers, including Karl Marx, has been gradually developed to prove that the universe is one indivisible whole, and that what seems to be its parts, if considered as substantial and self-existing, are mere illusions. The conception of a reality quite other than the world of appearance, a reality one, indivisible and unchanging, was introduced into Western philosophy by Parmenides, not nominally at least for mystical or religious reasons, but on the basis of a logical argument as to the impossibility of not being. Most subsequent metaphysical systems are the outcome of this fundamental idea. Belief in a reality quite different from what appears to the senses arises with irresistible force in certain moods, which are the source of most mysticism and of most metaphysics. While such a mood is dominant, the need of logic is not felt, and accordingly the more thoroughgoing mystics do not employ logic, but appeal directly to the immediate deliverance of their insight. When the intensity of emotional conviction subsides, a person who is in the habit of reasoning will search for logical grounds in favor of the belief which he finds in himself. But since the belief already exists, he will be very hospitable to any ground that suggests itself. The paradoxes apparently proved by his logic are really the paradoxes of mysticism and are the goal which he feels his logic must reach if it is to be in accordance with insight. The logic of mysticism shows, as is natural, the defects which are inherent in anything malicious. The impulse to logic, not felt while the mystic mood is dominant, reasserts itself as the mood fades, but with a desire to retain the vanishing insight, or at least to prove that it was insight, and that what seems to contradict it is illusion. The logic which thus arises is not quite disinterested or candid, and is inspired by a certain hatred of the daily world to which it is to be applied. Such an attitude naturally does not tend to the best results. Everyone knows that to read an author simply in order to refute him is not the way to understand him. And to read the book of nature with a conviction that it is all illusion is just as unlikely to lead to understanding. If our logic is to find the common world intelligible, it must not be hostile, but must be inspired by a genuine acceptance. In our active life, where we have to exercise choice and to prefer this to that of two possible acts, it is necessary to have distinction of good and evil, or at least of better and worse. But this distinction, like everything pertaining to action, belongs to what mysticism regards as the world of illusion. In our contemplative life, where action is not called for, it is possible to be impartial and to overcome the ethical dualism which action requires. So long as we remain merely impartial, we may be content to say that both the good and evil of action are illusions. But if, as we must do if we are to have the mystic vision, we find the whole world worthy of love and worship, we shall say that there is a higher good than that of action, and that this higher good belongs to the whole world as it is in reality. In this way, the twofold attitude and the apparent vacillation of mysticism are explained and justified. The possibility of this universal love and joy in all that exists is of supreme importance for the conduct and happiness of life, and gives inestimable value to the mystic emotion, apart from any creeds which may be built upon it. But if we are not to be led into false beliefs, it is necessary to realize exactly what the mystic emotion reveals. It reveals a possibility of human nature, a possibility of a nobler, happier, freer life than any that can otherwise be achieved. But it does not reveal anything about the non-human, or about the nature of the universe in general. Good and bad, and even the higher good that mysticism finds everywhere, are the reflections of our own emotions on other things, not part of the substance of things as they are in themselves. And therefore, an impartial contemplation, freed from all preoccupation with self, will not judge things good or bad, although it is very easily combined with that feeling of universal love, which leads the mystic to say that the whole world is good. The hope of satisfaction in our more human desires, the hope of demonstrating that the world has this or that desirable ethical characteristic, is not one which, so far as I can see, a scientific philosophy can do anything whatever to satisfy. The difference between a good world and a bad one is a difference in the particular characteristics of the particular things that exist in these worlds. Ethical interests must remain in the background. Some kind of ethical interest may inspire study, but none must obtrude in the detail or be expected in the special results which are sought. The physicist or chemist is not now required to prove the ethical importance of ions or atoms. In pre-scientific ages, this was not the case. Physics, as it appears in Plato, for example, is full of ethical notions. It is an essential part of its purpose to show that the Earth is worthy of admiration. The modern physicist, on the contrary, though he has no wish to deny that the Earth is admirable, is not concerned, as physicist, with its ethical attributes. He is merely concerned to find out facts, not to consider whether they are good or bad. In religion, and in every deeply serious view of the world and of human destiny, there is an element of submission, a realization of the limits of human power, which is somewhat lacking in the modern world, with its quick material successes and its insolent belief in the boundless possibilities of progress. The submission which religion inculcates in action is essentially the same in spirit as that which science teaches in thought, and the ethical neutrality by which its victories have been achieved is the outcome of that submission. Human beings cannot, of course, wholly transcend human nature. Something subjective, if only the interest that determines the direction of our attention, must remain in all our thought. But scientific philosophy comes nearer to objectivity than any other human pursuit, and gives us, therefore, the closest constant and the most intimate relation with the outer world that it is possible to achieve. Scientific philosophy represents, though as yet only in a nascent condition, a higher form of thought than any pre-scientific belief or imagination. And, like every approach to self-transcendence, it brings with it a rich reward in increase of scope and breadth and comprehension. A truly scientific philosophy will be more humble, more arduous, offering less glitter of outward mirage to flatter fallacious hopes, but more indifferent to fate, and more capable of accepting the world without the tyrannous imposition of our human and temporary demands. Cosmic purpose. Modern scientists, if they are not hostile or indifferent to religion, cling to one belief which they think can survive amid the wreck of the former dogmas, the belief, namely, of cosmic purpose. The doctrine has several forms, but all have in common the conception of evolution as having a direction towards something valuable, which, in some sense, gives the reason for the whole long process. Many questions are raised by this theory. Let us begin with the most definite. In what sense, if any, is biology reducible to physics? As to the origin of life, the majority of biologists think that living matter is really a physico-chemical mechanism. The Encyclopedia Britannica states, "A living organism, from the point of view of the scientific observer, is a self-regulating, self-repairing, physico-chemical complex mechanism. What we call life is the sum of its physico-chemical processes, forming a continuous interdependent series without break and without the interference of any mysterious extraneous force. Every step in the process is determined by that which preceded it and determines that which follows. As to the origin of life, it must be supposed that long ago, when conditions became favorable, relatively high compounds of various kinds were formed. Many of these would be quite unstable, breaking down almost as soon as formed. Others might be stable and merely persist, but still others might tend to reform, to assimilate, as fast as they broke down. Once started on this track, such a growing compound or mixture would inevitably tend to perpetuate itself and might combine with or feed on others less complex than itself. End of quote. But the question of the relation between physiology and psychology, or body and mind, is even more difficult. There are two distinct questions. Can our bodily behavior be supposed due to physiological causes alone? And what is the relation of mental phenomena to concurrent actions of the body? It is only bodily behavior that is open to public observation. Our thoughts may be inferred by others, but can only be perceived by ourselves. This, at least, is what common sense would say. In theoretical strictness, we cannot observe the actions of bodies, but only certain effects which they have on us. What others observe at the same time may be similar, but will always differ, in a greater or less degree, from what we observe. For this and other reasons, the gap between physics and psychology is not so wide as was formerly thought. Physics may be regarded as predicting what we shall see in certain circumstances, and in this sense it is a branch of psychology, since our seeing is a mental event. This point of view has come to the fore in modern physics through the desire to make only assertions that are empirically verifiable, combined with the fact that a verification is always an observation by some human being, and therefore an occurrence such as psychology considers. But all this belongs to the philosophy of the two sciences rather than to their practice. Their techniques remain distinct, in spite of the rapprochement between their subject matters. As we saw earlier, if our bodily actions all have physiological causes, our minds become causally unimportant. It is only by bodily acts that we can communicate with others or have any effect upon the outer world. What we think only matters if it can affect what our bodies do. Since, however, the distinction between what is mental and what is physical is only one of convenience, our bodily acts may have causes lying wholly within physics, and yet mental events may be among their causes. The practical issue is not to be stated in terms of mind and body. It may perhaps be stated as follows. Are our bodily acts determined by physico-chemical laws? And if they are, is there nevertheless an independent science of psychology in which we study mental events directly, without the intervention of the concept of matter? Neither of these questions can be answered with any confidence, though there is some evidence in favor of an affirmative answer to the first of them. The evidence is not direct. We cannot calculate a person's movements as we can those of the planet Jupiter. But no sharp line can be drawn between human bodies and the lowest forms of life. There is nowhere such a gap as would tempt us to say, here, physics and chemistry cease to be adequate. There is no sharp line even between living and dead matter. It seems probable, therefore, that physics and chemistry are supreme throughout. With regard to the possibility of an independent science of psychology, even less can be said at present. To some extent, psychoanalysis has attempted to create such a science, but the success of this attempt, insofar as it avoids physiological causation, may still be questioned. I incline, though with hesitation, to the view that there will ultimately be a science embracing both physics and psychology, though distinct from either as at present developed. The technique of physics was developed under the influence of a belief in the metaphysical reality of matter, which now no longer exists, and the new quantum mechanics has a different technique, which dispenses with false metaphysics. The technique of psychology, to some extent, was developed under a belief in the metaphysical reality of the mind. It seems possible that when physics and psychology have both been completely freed from these lingering errors, they will both develop into one science dealing neither with mind nor with matter, but with events, which will not be labelled either physical or mental. In the meantime, the question of the scientific status of psychology must remain open. Some philosophers maintain that the distinctive concept of psychology is personality. We may take the term as meaning some unifying principle, which binds together the constituents of one mind, causing them all to modify each other. The idea is vague. It stands for the soul, insofar as this is still thought to be defensible. It differs from the soul in not being a bare entity, but a kind of quality of wholeness. It is thought, by those who believe in it, that everything in the mind of John Smith has a John Smithy quality, which makes it impossible for anything quite similar to be in anyone else's mind. If you are trying to give a scientific account of John Smith's mind, you must not be content with general rules, such as can be given for all pieces of matter indiscriminately. You must remember that the events concerned are happening to that particular person, and are what they are because of his whole history and character. There is something attractive about this view, but I see no reason to regard it as true. It is, of course, obvious that two people in the same situation may react differently because of differences in their past histories, but the same is true of two bits of iron of which one has been magnetized and the other not. Memories, one supposes, are engraved on the brain and affect behavior through a difference of physical structure. The belief that personality is mysterious and irreducible has no scientific warrant and is accepted chiefly because it is flattering to our human self-esteem. Rather, I am thinking of the actual quality of the subjective experience. Seeing is one thing, recollecting is another. The relations to the past and the future, in psychology as elsewhere, are causal relations, not relations of interpenetration. Memory does not prolong the existence of the past. It is merely one way in which the past has effects. With regard to space, the matter is similar but more difficult. There are two kinds of space, that in which one person's private experiences are situated, and that of physics, which contains other people's bodies, chairs and tables, the sun, moon and stars. Not merely as reflected in our private sensations, but as we suppose them to be in themselves. This second sort is hypothetical and can, with perfect logic, be denied by any person who is willing to suppose that the world contains nothing but his own experiences. As for the subjective kind of space, there is the visual space containing all my visual experience. There is the space of touch. There is, as William James pointed out, the voluminousness of a stomachache, and so on. When I am considered as one thing among a world of things, every form of subjective space is inside me. The starry heavens that I see are not the remote starry heavens of the cosmos, but an effect of the stars on me. What I see is in me, not outside of me. The stars of the cosmos are in physical space, which is outside me, but which I only arrive at by inference, not through analysis of my own experience. The statement that space expresses an order within personality is true of my private space, not of physical space. The accompanying statement that space does not isolate personality would only be correct if physical space also were inside me. The doctrine of cosmic purpose must also contend with the difficulty of explaining the necessity of a temporal evolution. The emergent form of the doctrine of cosmic purpose, which we have next to consider, avoids this difficulty and emphatically upholds the reality of time, according to the theory of emergence. At an earlier stage, nothing in the universe foresees a later stage, but a kind of blind impulsion leads to those changes which bring more developed forms into existence, so that, in some rather obscure sense, the end is implicit in the beginning. I will quote the philosopher Samuel Alexander, who says that inanimate matter, living matter, and mind have appeared successively, and continues. He says, "This growth is one of what is called emergence. Life emerges from matter and mind from life. A living being is also a material being, but one so fashioned as to exhibit a new quality, which is life. And the same thing may be said of the transition from life to mind. A minded being is also a living being, but one of such complexity or development, so finely organized in certain of its parts, and particularly in its nervous system, as to carry mind, or if you please to use the word, consciousness. He goes on to say that there is no reason why this process should cease with mind. On the contrary, and I quote, "It suggests a further quality of existence beyond mind, which is related to mind as mind to life or life to matter. That quality I call deity, and the being which possesses it I call God. It seems to me, therefore, that all things point to the emergence of this quality, and that is why I said that science itself, when it takes the wider view, requires deity. The world is striving or tending to deity, but deity has not in its distinctive nature as yet emerged at this stage of the world's existence." He goes on to say that there is no reason why this process should cease with mind. On the contrary, and I quote, "It suggests a further quality of existence beyond mind, which is related to mind as mind to life or life to matter. That quality I call deity, and the being which possesses it I call God. It seems to me, therefore, that all things point to the emergence of this quality, and that is why I said that science itself, when it takes the wider view, requires deity. The world is striving or tending to deity, but deity has not in its distinctive nature as yet emerged at this stage of the world's existence." He adds that for him, God is not a creator as in religions, but created. There is a close affinity between Samuel Alexander's views and those of Henri Bergson's views in his book, Creative Evolution. Bergson holds that determinism is mistaken because, in the course of evolution, genuine novelties emerge, which could not have been predicted in advance or even imagined. There is a mysterious force which urges everything to evolve. For example, an animal which cannot see has some mystic foreboding of sight and proceeds to act in a way that leads to the development of eyes. At each moment something new emerges, but the past never dies, being preserved in memory, for forgetting is only apparent. Thus the world is continually growing richer in content, and will in time become quite a nice sort of place. The one essential is to avoid the intellect, which looks backward and is static. What we must use is intuition, which contains within itself the urge to creative novelty. I do not suggest that Samuel Alexander accepts Henri Bergson's philosophy in its entirety, but there is a similarity in their views, though they have developed them independently. In any case, their theories agree in emphasizing time and in the belief that, in the course of evolution, unpredictable novelties emerge. Various difficulties make the philosophy of emergent evolution unsatisfactory. Perhaps the chief of these is that, in order to escape from determinism, prediction is made impossible. And yet the adherents of this theory predict the future existence of God. Alexander maintains that we have a vague awareness of deity in some experiences, which he describes as numinous. The feeling which characterizes such experiences is, he says, the sense of mystery, of something which may terrify us or may support us in our helplessness, but at any rate which is other than anything we know by our senses or our reflection. He gives no reason for attaching importance to this feeling, or for supposing that, as his theory demands, mental development makes it become a larger element in life. From anthropologists, one would infer the exact opposite. The sense of mystery, of a friendly or hostile non-human force, plays a far greater part in the life of primitive people than in that of civilized people. Indeed, if religion is to be identified with this feeling, every step in known human development has involved a diminution of religion. There have been, it is urged, three stages in evolution: matter, life, and mind. We have no reason to suppose that the world has finished evolving, and there is therefore likely, at some later date, to be a fourth phase, and a fifth, and a sixth, and so on, one would have supposed. But no, with the fourth phase, evolution is to be complete. Now, matter could not have foreseen life, and life could not have foreseen mind, but mind can dimly foresee the next stage. It is obvious that all this is the merest guesswork. It may happen to be true, but there is no rational ground for supposing so. The philosophy of emergence is quite right in saying that the future is unpredictable, but having said this, it at once proceeds to predict the future. People are more unwilling to give up the word God than give up the idea for which the word has hitherto stood. Emergent evolutionists, having become persuaded that God did not create the world, are content to say that the world is creating God. But beyond the name, such a God has almost nothing in common with the object of traditional worship. With regard to cosmic purpose in general, in whichever of its forms, there are two criticisms to be made. In the first place, those who believe in cosmic purpose always think that the world will go on evolving in the same direction as hitherto. In the second place, they hold that what has already happened is evidence of the good intentions of the universe. Both these propositions are open to question. As to the direction of evolution, the argument is mainly derived from what has happened on this earth since life began. Now, this earth is a very small corner of the universe. Before the Copernican revolution, it was natural to suppose that God's purposes were specially concerned with the earth. But now this has become an unplausible hypothesis. If it is the purpose of the cosmos to evolve mind, it is, of course, possible that there will be more mind later on, or somewhere else. But of this we have no jot of scientific evidence. It may seem odd that life should occur by accident, but in such a large universe, accidents will happen. And even if we accept the rather curious view that the cosmic purpose is specially concerned with our little planet, we still find that there is reason to doubt whether it intends quite what the theologians say it does. The Earth is likely to remain habitable for some considerable time, but not forever. 1 million years gives us some time to prepare for the end, and we may hope that in the meantime both astronomy and space travel will have made considerable progress. We may have discovered another star with habitable planets, and be able to fire ourselves off to it with a speed approaching that of light. Cruising around the universe, however, even if it is to come with the most perfect scientific skill, cannot prolong life forever. The second law of thermodynamics tells us that, on the whole, energy is always passing from more concentrated to less concentrated forms, and that, in the end, it will have all passed into a form in which further change is impossible. When that has happened, if not before, life must cease. That mind is the only reality, and that the spaces and times of the cosmos are created by it, there is much to be said about this. But those who adopt it, in the hope of escaping from depressing conclusions, do not quite realize what it entails. Everything that I know directly is part of my mind, and the inferences by which I arrive at the existence of other things are by no means conclusive. It may be, therefore, that nothing exists except my mind. In that case, when I die, the universe will go out. But if I am going to admit minds other than my own, I must admit the whole cosmological universe, since the evidence is exactly equally strong in both cases. Against any form of the doctrine that mind is the only reality, there is the fact that our evidence for other people's minds is derived by inference from our evidence for their bodies. Other people, therefore, if they have minds, have bodies. Oneself alone may possibly be a disembodied mind, but only if oneself alone exists. I come now to the last question in our discussion of cosmic purpose, namely, is what has happened hitherto evidence of the good intentions of the universe? The alleged ground for believing this, as we have seen, is that the universe has produced us. I cannot deny it, But are we really so splendid as to justify such a long prologue? The philosophers lay stress on values. They say that we think certain things good, and that since these things are good, we must be very good to think them so. But this is a circular argument. A being with other values might think ours so atrocious as to be proof that we were inspired by Satan. Is there not something a trifle absurd in the spectacle of human beings holding a mirror before themselves and thinking what they behold so excellent as to prove that a cosmic purpose must have been aiming at it all along? The human species, as a curious accident in a backwater, is intelligible. This mixture of virtues and vices is such as might be expected to result from a fortuitous origin. But only abysmal self-complacency can see in the human species a reason which omniscience could consider adequate as a motive for the creator. Determinism. Determinism has a twofold character. On the one hand, it is a practical maxim for the guidance of scientific investigators. On the other hand, it is a general doctrine as to the nature of the universe. The practical maxim may be sound, even if the general doctrine is uncertain. Let us begin with the maxim and proceed afterwards to the doctrine. The maxim advises people to seek causal laws, that is to say, rules connecting events at one time with events at another. In everyday life, we guide our conduct by rules of this sort, but the rules that we use purchase simplicity at the expense of accuracy. Such rules will not do for science, which wants something invariable. Its ideal was fixed by Newtonian astronomy, where, by means of the law of gravitation, the past and future positions of the planets can be calculated throughout periods of indefinite vastness. The search for laws governing phenomena has been more difficult elsewhere than in relation to the orbits of the planets, because elsewhere there is a greater complexity of causes of different kinds, and a smaller degree of regularity of periodic recurrence. Nevertheless, causal laws have been discovered in chemistry, in electromagnetism, in biology, and even in economics. The discovery of causal laws is the essence of science, and therefore there can be no doubt that scientists do right to look for them. If there is any region where there are no causal laws, that region is inaccessible to science. But the maxim that scientists should seek causal laws is as obvious as the maxim that mushroom gatherers should seek mushrooms. Determinism, as a general doctrine, asserts that complete determinism of the future by the past is always possible, theoretically, if we know enough about the past and about causal laws. The investigator, observing some phenomenon, should, according to this principle, be able to find previous circumstances and causal laws which together made the phenomenon inevitable. And, having discovered the laws, he should be able, when he observes similar circumstances, to infer that a similar phenomenon is going to occur.